We're doing the book of Shofetim. We're up to the middle of what's called the 18th chapter. We had learned how Yehonasan, this priest, this Levite, who became the priest at Micha's home, he had given good tidings to the tribe of Dan. And now when the tribe of Dan is traveling north to the Chatzbani, to the area where the Jordan begins, they're passing by Micha's house, and they take Yehonasan to be their priest, and they take the molten image, the ephod, the icons, the trophim. They take all of that, and they travel, and they say, these will be our idols when we settle that new territory up north. And the Kohen is happy to go with him. They tell him, look, you'll be a priest for a whole tribe now. And as they're traveling, so they place their women and kids and everything in the front, because they know from behind, Micha might charge them. So Micha discovers what happens, and he gathers his compound, he gathers everyone with him, and they charge, they catch up to the tribe of Dan, and they call out, hey, what's going on? So the tribe of Dan turn around, and they say, what are you getting all excited about? And Micha says, you took my God. I made that God with my own hands. You took my Kohen. You went off. What'd you leave me? What do you mean, what am I getting all excited about? So that's a very funny pasuk. Sometimes you look at the psukim and you feel like the psukim are mocking someone as they talk. You know, you took the God I made with my own two hands. Yeah, okay. The tribe of Dan say to him, you know, you really shouldn't make your voice so audible, because there are embittered men here on their way to war, and we wouldn't want someone to hurt you, and you should, you know, cause your death and everyone else in your house. Not a good idea. So they continue traveling, and Micha saw that they were stronger than he was. So he turned around, went back home, and so they took what Micha had made, his idols. They took the priest that was his, and they traveled northward to the city of Laish, a place where people were complacent and secure, and they attacked them and burnt the city down, but there was no one there to save them, because it was far away from Sidon, which is the nation further north. They didn't have an alliance with any other people, and it was there in the valley, they had built a little city, and so the tribe of Dan took it over, and they named the city Dan. They set up this idol, and they set up Yonasan to be priest for their tribe until their land was exiled. And here, Chazal asks, how could that be? King David let this stay. King Solomon let this stay. So the commentaries discusses, how could that be that this was around for so long? Chazal tell us that David abolished it, and then it came back. It kept on coming back. So the Navi finished one terrible story of Pesel Micha, which is a terrible story if you think about it. Micha was so nice to this priest, and he just took advantage of him. The tribe of Dan does open theft, and Micha can't do anything about it. And then the tribe of Dan sets up this idol in their midst, and no one does anything about it. So the Navi again stresses that in those days there was no king in Israel. Ein melech b'Yisrael. There was no king in Israel. And now we're up to the second story, which is a story which is even more phenomenal than the first one. The story of the concubine, the Pilegesh on the hilltop. So this is another terrible mark in Jewish history. If we have one terrible mark, the sale of Yosef in next week's parasha, so this is terrible mark number two, or maybe number three. Maybe number two was the story of the tribe of Dan, and number three is this story. Now, there is this Levite who lived by the foothills of Mount Ephraim, and he married a concubine from Beis Lechem in Judean territory. And it says, Vatizne alav pilagsho. His concubine was unfaithful. and she left him and went to her father's house. And here there's a discussion, what happened that she ran away in the middle of the night? One understanding in our sages is that there was a bug in his food, and she left the fly in his soup and brought it to him like that. Another understanding is that she did something that she endangered his physical well-being. Chazal described that in those days there were certain things which today are commonplace, but in those days if you did it, it was considered like you're really endangering someone else, and she did that. So if you guys are curious what it was, so maybe at the end of class we could discuss it. So she goes back home to Beit Lechem.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so happy someone asked. What is a concubine? Okay, so let's take 3 minutes to understand what a concubine is. First, let's understand what a wife is, okay? And then we'll go over to a concubine. So, before the Torah was given, you had this concept where a man and a woman wanted to get together. They'd get together, they'd move in together, and they were married. And then whenever they decided it was over, so she could leave and it was over. Or he could ask her to leave and it was over. Comes the Torah and tells us we're going to have 2 stages to marriage. Kiddushin and Nisuin. Kiddushin is that the two agree that they're getting together. So he could give her a ring like we do today. He gives her the ring and says, Arei at mekudeshet li, with this ring you are hereby designated to me, in accordance with our tradition. And once he puts that ring on her finger, once she accepts, so then she's mekudeshes, which means the two of them, biblically, are man and wife. And if someone were told that he should be intimate with her, he should rather give up his life than be intimate with her, because she's a married woman. But she's not fully married, because it's only step one. Until she moves into his house, step two hasn't been accomplished. So there is a step two called Nisuin, which is the finalization of their marriage, in which she moves into his house, and then everything applies. Then they become one in the sense that they inherit one another, and many halachot apply. If she passes away, he must become defiled for her, and when it comes to the ksubo, all the agreements all go into play when they get nisun, when they get finally married. But technically, biblically, after kiddushin, the main things are relevant. The only thing is that without nisun, so he doesn't really owe her that much. What happens if he divorces her? So he doesn't owe her any money. He says, goodbye, finished. He writes her a get. He does have to write her a divorce contract, but he doesn't owe her as much because they didn't finalize the marriage. So a person can do kiddushin in one of 3 ways. Either by giving her something of monetary value, or by writing up a contract in which he writes, I am hereby marrying you, I'm doing kiddushin, that's not our ksuba, or by being intimate with her once. There are 2 witnesses that see them go into a room alone, and he tells her, I'm hereby being intimate with you for the sake of kiddushin, so that you be my wife. And that's it, and then they are legally kiddushin. She is his mekudeshet, she is an ashesi, she is a married woman. They just haven't finished off the marriage. Now, the rabbi saw that there's nothing to stop a guy from doing only kiddushin. Now, if they didn't move in, then if they want to get divorced, he doesn't owe her that much. So the rabbis were concerned that people are going to do this often, and the rabbis then made an institution that there's no such thing. We rabbis prohibit a man and a woman to be intimate without writing her a ksuba, without taking her under the canopy and doing nisuin. We go under the canopy, it's a way of showing that now we're alone together. Really, we go under the canopy before we even did kiddushin, right? We go under the canopy, we go under the chuppah, and then we put the ring on her finger and say, kiddushin, arat mekudeshetli. And then we give her the ksuba, which is the contract which really obligates us after we're going to do nisuin, after we do the second stage. And then we make 7 blessings, right? Sheva brachos, over what? Over the fact that we're under a canopy. And now, after we finish the 7 blessings, then the canopy takes effect. Meaning it has no halachic relevance until we're done. At the very end, after the 7 blessings, so then the canopy becomes a legal chuppah, and then we have nisuin. We also go into the cheder yichud, we fulfill another opinion of what you have to do to show that you moved in together. But this is our marriage. It begins with kiddushin, and then we give her the ksuba, which is a rabbinic institution to make sure that a guy doesn't take it too easily to divorce his wife. So the rabbi said, write up a whole contract telling her you're going to clothe her and take care of her till the shirt off your back, and you're saying all your money and everything, all your assets are responsible to what you owe her in the ksuba, which includes giving her to eat, giving her clothing, living with her like man and wife. In the event of divorce or widowing, you're going to give her such and such a sum. So the rabbis made a whole big deal out of it. Write up a whole ksuba. We give her that. And the rabbi said, no living with your wife unless she has a kosher ksuba. If someone loses the ksuba, the couple have to go and rewrite one. They're not allowed to stay together till they have a kosher ksuba. And the rabbi said, no being with the woman until you finished your seven blessings and had nisuin under a chuppah. So that's a rabbinic institution to protect the women. We have many, many rabbinic institutions to protect the women. So this is one of them. So a concubine is a woman where you don't have all of that. The two can agree, we're going to be together. Now, she goes to mikvah. If she's a nida, then they're prohibited from being together. But there's no real financial obligation between the two. And whenever she wants to pick up and go, she can pick up and go. They can agree it's over. So technically, why is it that a man and a woman can't be together? There are two reasons. One is she's a nida. A woman doesn't go to mikvah till she gets married. And she's not allowed to go to mikvah till she gets married. And number two is because the Torah says that it is a biblical prohibition for a woman to be a zona, a woman of ill repute. Now, if she's going to be sleeping with this guy today and the next guy next week, so that's a zona. Call it whatever you want, but that's what it is. So that's a biblical prohibition. It's prohibited for him. It's prohibited for her.
But if it's Jewish, she's technically not a zona.
Yeah, okay, so she is. She's not a zona for a kohen. But she's still a zona. There's still there's still prohibition to have a daughter of Israel be a zona. So now, what happens with a concubine is that they agree we're together. It's not that you're going to be with someone else tomorrow. You're going to be with me for as long as it's going to be, until we both decide to break up. So they could be together for 10 months or 3 years or 10 years, or like some people in Shoftim, till the end of their lives. Now, the whole idea of concubine worked. According to many commentaries, it was only permissible for kings, for leaders. Meaning, if you were a leader, then you were permitted to take a concubine, not only to marry a wife, but also to take a concubine. So this person might have been one of the leaders if he had a concubine. And we're going to see that the story, the way it reads, portrays him terribly. He seems like a very bad person. But our tradition is that he wasn't, that he was actually a very good person. And that doesn't seem to come out of the text at all. The text seems to portray this man in a very bad light. But at any rate, so he has this concubine. And again, when we first read the story, we assume he's wrong. Look, his wife ran away from him. But that's not what it says. It says, Vatizne alav. She was wrong. She did something that was unfaithful to him, whatever it was. And then she ran away, being unfaithful to him. And she went to her father's house, and after 4 months, he goes after her. He goes after her to appease her. She did something wrong, and he has to appease her. Guys, learn that, right? So he goes to appease her, and he brings his lad with him, and he brings some donkeys with him, and when she sees him, she brings her home to her father's house, and her father is very happy. And now here, the Navi calls her a na'ara, a young girl. Question, how old was she to begin with? Now his father-in-law holds on to him, and he's patient with his father-in-law, and he sticks around for 3 days, and they eat, and they drink, and they stay there. And on the fourth day, he gets up to leave. And her father says to his son-in-law, have some bread and then go. It's okay. He doesn't want to fight. He sits down. He eats with them. And they eat. They drink. And then her father says, do me a favor. You sleep. You'll have a good night. Sleep here and then you'll go. And the guy says, no, I got to go. He gets up to leave. And his father-in-law begs him. And he respects that and he stays that night. He gets up early the next morning. And he's ready to go. And his father-in-law again says, why don't you have a good meal and delay a little bit why don't you wait until the afternoon and then you'll go. And so he eats with him, then he gets up to go. And his father-in-law says, no, it's too late. The sun is waning. It's about to set. Stay overnight. and tomorrow we'll set up quickly and you'll go. But spend the night here so that you'll be comfortable leaving tomorrow. You'll leave early to your journey and you'll go to your tent. And the man refuses. So what do we learn from here? Don't push your luck. Sometimes as a parent or as a father-in-law, you try to get the kid to stay a little longer, eventually it explodes. There are many situations like this in life where you try to gain more and more and more, and you don't realize that at some point it's going to explode. You're not going to get all that. There was a guy who, this goes back a decade and a half ago, a guy told me, a woman knocked on their door, she's got no place to go. So his wife took her in, and the woman's a little crazy. She could sit there crying in the middle of the day, in the middle of the night, and all kinds of weird things that she does in the house. So I said, I suggest you get the woman out of your house. You have kids, and there are institutions for people like this, and then that's not the way to go. You know, you want to help the woman, help her to get to the right institution. But your house is not an institution. You have kids, and you and your wife, and you just live in this tiny basement. With all due respect, you want to do kindness, that's not the way to do it. Okay, they didn't listen. And this went on and on until one Shabbos afternoon, his wife blew it. In the middle of Shabbos, she got up and told the woman, out, out, or I'm calling the police now. I have no kindness on the woman. I don't understand this tzaddikus who could put up with such a woman in her house for so long. But when you push things, then it explodes at the worst time. It doesn't explode the way you'd want. There was another woman whose husband had serious issues, and I kept begging her, do me a favor, bring him to the psychiatric ward, let him get the help he needs. Let's set up a game plan and let's set it up right so that he gets the help he needs. Who are you helping by ignoring the issues? No. Until one day she gets up and takes him by surprise, brings in a bunch of men with white coats and has him institutionalized. Is that the way to go? With all due respect, you know, plan it, prepare it. Did you do him a favor by pushing it off for another 3 months and everyone suffered during those 3 months? Why? So the same story is about to happen here. The father-in-law kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and when you push too hard, so you think you've gained something, but no. In the end, when it explodes, so then everyone suffers more. And that's a rule that people don't want to learn in life. And if you think down, you say, okay, let me deal with it before it explodes. Let's think down the road a little bit. So he's going, and he's saying, I'm not sticking around. And his father-in-law, he can't hold him there. So they leave, and it's really late in the afternoon. And they're traveling, and they're passing Jerusalem, and the Navi calls Jerusalem the city of the Yevusi, which is how our sages understood that this story really happened long before this, because in the beginning of the book of Judges, we already conquered Jerusalem. So if Jerusalem is called the city of the Yevusi, that means this story happened even before the beginning of Judges. It happened just after Joshua passed away. And they're traveling, but it was getting very late. And the lad says to his master, why don't we go to the city of the Yevusi and sleep there? And he says, I'm not going to a Gentile city. We'll pass the hilltop and we'll go to the hilltop by Benjamin, to a Jewish city, and we're not spending the night there. Yeah.
Maybe I'm confused, but I thought King David took Jerusalem.
Thank you. It's a very good point. So it seems that King David took a specific part of Jerusalem, where the Yevusi really were, right? That's why the commentaries of Pshat say what you say, that they were passing by that part. But if the rest of Jerusalem was already conquered, so then he should have gone there. Meaning, it seems like all of Jerusalem was Yevusi at that point. And in the beginning of the book, we find that they conquered at least most of Jerusalem. So there was a stronghold of the Yevusi still present in Jerusalem. You're right. And that King David conquered. So again, we have to ask ourselves, is the Pasuk over here sticking in some irony? As the Pasuk stresses that he says, I will not go to a Gentile city, I will only go to a Jewish city. So they come to the hilltop. As the sun's setting, they come to a hilltop in the tribe of Benjamin. And they're at the center of town, in the main street, and no one invites them in. which was not a very Jewish way of behaving. But that's just the beginning. An old man comes from his work in the field. And that man was from the same territory. He was also from the mountains of Ephraim. And he was living now by that hilltop. But the rest of the hilltop were people from Benjamin. It was a hilltop of Benjamin. And he looks at the guest in the center of town. And the man asks him, where are you going and where are you coming from? He says, we're coming from Beit Lechem and we're headed to the foothills of the mountain of Ephraim. That's where I'm coming from. And I went to Beit Lechem. I'm headed towards the temple on my way. The temple in those times was Shiloh. And no one here is inviting me home. And I have everything I need. I have food. I have food for the donkeys. I have bread. I have wine. We're not missing anything. So the old man says, peace be with you. Everything you need's on me. Don't go to sleep out here in the street. And he brings him home. And he gives them food for the donkeys. And they wash their feet. And they sit down to eat and drink. And, yeah.
What does washing feet mean?
In those days, and even afterwards, in Arab countries, where people would walk around with sandals or barefoot, so their feet would get very dusty. We have paved roads. But they would feel the need to wash their feet as much as the need to wash their hands before eating. It was customary that people would wash their feet even before davening. It's brought in halacha. If you live in the Arab countries where it's customary to wash your feet, so then before davening, wash your hands and feet. That's for them. So they're sitting down to eat. And suddenly there are strong knocks on the door. And we'll pick up here, Bezat Shem, next week.
Just one question. I'll interrupt you. The first part of the talk when you spoke about this tribe of Dan, when they kept that idol, and he stressed that there wasn't, it was a time of judges, there was no king over them. But then you mentioned, I think, if I heard right, that they allowed that idol to stay there, but there were kings.
That's what the commentaries ask, right? So the commentaries ask. The commentaries say that it seems that there was a period where the kings abolished it, and then it resurfaced. And it remained there in the long run till the time they were exiled. So King David, King Solomon, they abolished it. And then afterwards it was quick to resurface. And and that sort of indicates that they didn't really do a good job abolishing it. Even the priest was taken in by King David. And he found his way back there and became a priest for idol worship again.
This is a strange story. On the one hand, they're mocking this guy because you made it yourself. And then they make it this.
No, so they didn't mock him. The verse seems to mock him. It doesn't say they do. No. The verse says, he's saying, the God I made with my own hands, Asher Asiti, that I made.
So they gave it, the Jews, certainly a position that seemed to be ill placed.
Sure not.
Sure.
On every front. It was immoral and unethical.
Yeah.
And
that whole concept of, you know, the lure of idolatry is hard to understand for me today. I mean, I understand that these were not primitive, spiritually backward people. These were high-level people that succumbed to this. And that what it was, it's very, you know, I don't think we have a lot of tightness about that one.
So,
as hard as it is for us, for the times we have today, that was their title.
I can't think of anything that we have, maybe, I could say, it has that degree, which is so not permitted and so commonplace and such a challenge. I mean, we have tons of lust and tons of Lashon Hara and tons of, you know, things that are there, but it seems to be that's a degree beyond. I don't know, maybe
I'll say, adultery and idolatry. They're both up there. And yet, both were happening then. And so today, you guys know the Talmud, the verses in Zechariah, that the sages abolished the desire for idolatry, right?
Somehow it was replaced. The Midrash I heard was something, but I don't know what.
But that's maybe for Thursday night, remind me, we'll learn that. There are opinions that say that he formed that form, meaning the figurines, the forms that he formed did have powers. There was a way of accessing forces within nature, forces of the stars, whatever forces they knew how to access, there, if you got the right timing to set up the idol, so then it was able to talk or whatever. That goes back to the old machlokas we were discussing, whether idols ever have any force or not, whether there's anything to it or not.
It seems the lure of that was, and the one bracha that seems that you can relate to today, you know, at the end of Shemon Esrei, God, my tongue from speaking, my lips from guile, you know, my soul. They add that on, they don't add on another thing that says, you know, don't steal or don't murder. I mean, they must have added that on because they realize how much we need divine assistance in that particular area. That's the only thing I could think of was as close that paragraph or two afterwards to Ayashi, but I could be way off base.
Think about the adult entertainment industry. Think on the new marriages.
It's a danger. I don't know. Maybe because they were pure in other areas and this thing was just so glaringly different. If you were born there, you'd be worshiping idols. I mean, forget it. it just seemed that I don't have I don't have a real idea of the lore of that degree. Yes, the adult entertainment. The internet and all that stuff, but somehow, you know, they would have their kids do this. They would train, right? I mean, they would set up in the family. There was something, I mean, when we do an Aveira, usually you ask yourself, is that what you want for your kid? Yeah. You'd say no, usually, unless you're really...
But you've got kids today who've grown up religious from birth. They hit teenagerhood, they find the internet, and they're gone.
I agree that we're talking degrees. Yes, clearly, there are. I don't understand enough making the whole concept of idolatry. I read something, but hasn't registered totally. I don't know. I get just getting that because it's this tribe of Dan who kept this for all these years, and the kind of excuse that there wasn't a king when they got it in place didn't hold so much because when there were powerful kings, but you did say that there were some that were able to.
Yeah.
So that's just.
Does the Tzibur want to take 10 minutes now to discuss the desire for idol worship? No. Okay. So no. Sorry.